Hello, everybody, and welcome to our 39th program, actually, in a treatise on white magic webinar commentaries. We're in Rule 5, and we're in the fourth part of Rule 5, the fourth program on Rule 5. We've been talking about the approach to the ashram and whether this is recognized in the life of the approaching disciple or not, and how he is supervised by an internal disciple, even though he doesn't realize that this is going on. But what might he recognize in his own nature as this approach is made? And this, I think, includes the approach to accepted discipleship. I believe there are 2 years or so, the Tibetan talks about, when this supervision is going on, he will notice in himself increased mental activity as he gradually learns to assume productive control of his mind. He will notice increased responsiveness to ideas and increased capacity to vision the plan of hierarchy. And this is a review of what we covered last time in number 38. And he will recognize increased psychic sensitiveness, and DK does talk about the need not to cultivate the lower psychic powers, which were once in our possession, before we have cultivated the higher psychic powers. And this begins to occur, when one is truly becoming an initiate of the third degree. Otherwise, one can be swept off his feet and become unreliable and veiled as far as the higher impressions go. So here we are at the beginning of a treatise on white magic, video 39. We're on page 169. And we are beginning an interesting subject. So here we go. There is much misapprehension in people's minds as to how a master lets an accepted disciple become aware that he is accepted. Okay, and some of this, of course, we will find in the six stages of discipleship, in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1. How does a master let an accepted disciple become aware that he is accepted? Remember, at the time this was written, only 400 or so accepted disciples existed in the world, that is, those students of the wisdom who were in full service and knew they were accepted disciples. Others were standing on the threshold of accepted discipleship, and now much greater numbers, I think, can be expected if we were to ask that question. We've had the revolution in consciousness, a great wave from the east sweeping over the west. We've had the Christ taking over the vestures of the Buddha, I think in 1966, which corresponded with great expansions of consciousness around the world, but especially emanating from the United States. We've had big changes since this book was written. An impression is abroad that he is told so, and that an interview is accorded wherein the master accepts him and starts him to work. Such is not the case. Okay, so DK is helping us correct impressions which are false. Okay, I just want to make that a little bit more. Yeah. The occult law holds good in discipleship as in initiation. The man goes forward blindly. Okay, this is a law. And he must discover for himself his true state. He hopes, but he does not know. He expects that it may be so, but no tangible assurance is given. From a study of himself and of the requirements, he arrives at the conclusion that perhaps he has reached the status of accepted disciple. He therefore acts on that assumption, and with care, he watches his acts, guards his words, and controls his thought so that no overt act, unnecessary word, or unkind thought will break the rhythm which he believes he has set up. So this is the condition in which he finds himself, and no one comes to tell him, you are an accepted disciple. Now, D.K. does give such things as the evidences in the Adina 1 book on the six stages of discipleship. You know, there might be a dream experience. There might be an experience in meditation. There might be an interview in the master's ashram. Various evidences may confirm for the individual that he has reached this point, but he has to act accordingly. He has to act as if. If he evaluates the requirements and believes he has reached those requirements or fulfilled them, then he proceeds to act as if this stage has in fact been reached, and then further confirmation will come. He hopes, but he does not know. He expects that it may be so, but no tangible assurance is given. From a study of himself and of the requirements, he arrives at the conclusion that perhaps he has reached the status of accepted disciple. He therefore acts on that assumption, and with care. He watches his acts, guards his words, and controls his thoughts, so that no overt act or unnecessary word or unkind thought will break the rhythm that he believes has been set up. He proceeds with his work, but intensifies his meditation. He searches his motives. He seeks to equip his mental body. He sets before himself the ideal of service and seeks ever to serve. And then, when he is so engrossed in the work on hand that he has forgotten himself, suddenly one day he will see the one who has for so long seen him. Well, the method is clear, is it not? The method is clear. And maybe, you know, some of us find ourselves in this situation, and we've been given, we've been told what to do, what to do. We are certainly in this kind of work seeking to equip our mental body. We have before us always the ideal of service, and to serve the strengthening and the illumination of the mental body of our fellow human beings is a service, and people who are equipped through the study of this kind of teaching are in the position to pass on the light. They are carriers of the light, light bearers, and the second ray, which radiates from these pages, is the ray of light-bearing influence, as it is said. So anyway, the confirmation may come in two ways: in full waking consciousness, or by the registering of an interview on the physical brain as it has been participated in the hours of sleep. And if it's in full waking consciousness, I suppose this would normally be a meditative experience. We don't all like Alice Bailey. Of course, she didn't anticipate it, but we do not expect that, as happened for her, Master KH or one of the other masters will walk into a room where she was alone and consult with her about her discipleship and possible usefulness. Even then, though, he was saying there's a few things you have to take care of in your character. And what would he say to us? What would he say to us? Obviously, there are still a few things we all have to take care of in our character. And even though focus on character is not the main goal of discipleship, especially accepted discipleship, perhaps for the probationary path it is a major focus, yet nevertheless, improvement of the character can never be ignored when the opportunity to do so arises, or when there is recognition of the need to do so, then opportunity will arise. But accompanying this recognition of the event by the disciples will come certain other recognitions. Now, let's see. Certain other recognitions. So we who are, those who can justly prepare for accepted discipleship, whether in this life or rather immediately ahead, we want to pay attention to everything that DK says about it so that we can recognize the signs. So certain other recognitions. The event is recognized as past all controversy. No doubt remains in the disciples' mind. Something has happened, whether in meditation or in the hours of sleep, and or through the presence of a thought form of the master. There are benevolent thought forms which can perform certain tasks, but the disciple knows this has happened. There is also recognized an inhibition on the disciple's part to mention the happening to anyone. Months or years may slip away before the disciple will mention it, and then only to those who are also recognized as disciples or to some fellow worker, also under the same group influence. So related to similar work, not necessarily running around to those in other ashrams or affiliated with other ashrams to tell the story. It has to be of value. This telling of the story has to have a purpose, and that purpose is not to call attention to oneself, but to strengthen the work in some way. So only to those who are recognized as disciples or to some fellow worker, also under the same group influence, and one shares a certain task together, whose right it is to know, and whose right is sanctioned by the master of the group. I guess a lot of in intuition is needed to see to whom one might be able to share this kind of event. I suppose to clarify the nature of the event and to prove that in fact it does happen is of value, or perhaps to compare events with someone who for whom it has occurred. These are rather, well, they are inner events, but they do occur and they are the evidence of a certain state of responsibility. I'm remembering Mary Bailey in The Office, you know, she, in speaking of who did what and who was to do what in that office situation, group situation, she would speak of spheres of responsibility, spheres or circles of responsibility. I think sphere was the right word. And it became clear that this was an impersonal matter and not something which indicated a focus upon hierarchical status, as is so often the case with external hierarchies. So let's just say that what we say, let's see, up here, no doubt that it has occurred. Oh, how about spelling, huh? And here, the idea of discretion. Discretion. Certain factors governing the master's relation to the disciple are gradually recognized and begin to govern the disciple's life. So, we're talking about accepted discipleship. Accepted, ACDS. Oh, heavens, I've got to do better than that, don't I? ACD, accepted discipleship, ACDD. All right, I never know quite. We're speaking of accepted discipleship. And the probationary period, which follows, which I suppose leads up to it and may follow to a degree, we are speaking of enhanced inner contacts and their reality. This goes beyond the theoretical approach. Okay. So what are these factors governing the master's relation to the disciple, which are gradually recognized by the disciple and govern the life, begin to govern the life? Okay, point A. He recognizes that at his point of contact with his master, that his point of contact with his master, points of contact, sorry, are governed by group emergency and need and deal with group service. It's not about an individual relationship for its own sake, right? It gradually dawns on him that his master is only interested in him insofar as his ego, his nature on the higher mental plane, can be used in service through the personality on the physical plane. yeah, this is not about spending a nice evening together. Not about a personal relationship. He begins to realize that the master works with his soul. Soul and ego here being rather equivalent terms, even though the lower case is used. DK is not using that term ego to indicate the way it is normally used by people, indicating the lower personal self. This is not about spending a nice evening together. All right. The master, excuse me, works with his soul or ego. Therefore, it is his ego which is on rapport with the master and not the personal self. So we would say he has to be in the right meditative state before true contact with the master becomes possible, and such contact is not the overriding objective anyway. It may happen for the purposes of direction and illumination and to advance the group work, but it's not about being able to contact the master at any time you want for your own personal purposes. Okay, so in general, one does not contact the master for personal purposes. When something about the work really has to be advanced, then it's possible. His problem, therefore, becomes increasingly clear, and this is the problem of all disciples. It is to keep the channel of communication open between the soul and the brain via the mind, so that when the master seeks to communicate, he can do so easily. So, you know, at any moment we could be asked, is this alignment operating at this time? Soul, mind, brain. There's much more in the mind than is in the brain. There's much more in the soul than is in the mind. But at least the channel has to be kept open so that what the master seeks to convey can be conveyed. Sometimes a master has to wait weeks. This is a very practical statement. Sometimes the master has to wait weeks before he can get the disciples here. For the channel upward is closed and the soul is not en rapport with the brain. And this is especially true in the early stages of discipleship. So a real, attentiveness, inward attentiveness is needed. A real inward attentiveness is needed, and yet one must be able to go about one's business on the outer planes without interruption. So this is a dual state of consciousness. Okay. I'm going to put that one in, if you don't mind. Okay, so, state of consciousness. Almost there. All right. Well, we have to practice that, don't we? We have to make sure that we really do have that ability to remain inwardly attentive, alert, while doing the outer things that our duties require. So that's point A, I think. And let's see, how did we express it here? Certain factors. Certain recognitions. No doubt. Discretion. And in this case, factors are being discussed, which are gradually recognized. Okay, and group service is governing his contact. That's basically what we're learning. So group service and no strictly personal need is governing the disciples' contact with the master. All right. Sometimes this thing jumps around a bit. And there it is. All right. Now, what other factors are here? This is point A. Point B, he finds that it is he who shuts the door in the majority of cases through lower psychism, physical disability, and lack of mind control, and he therefore discovers that he has to work constantly and ceaselessly with his lower self. So the accepted disciple still has much work to do with the lower self in order to keep the door of communication open with the master or higher members of the ashram than he is presently. Okay. So attentiveness, you know, attentiveness again, and not allowing indulgence in certain fantasies and unwholesome types of thought or desire, keeping the physical body in reasonable shape and allowing the, preventing the mind from just running out of control. So in fact, we're the ones who close the door, and it's not as if we're always in the right kind of condition to receive, even though we might think we are. And then point C, he finds that one of the first things he has to do is to learn to discriminate between. Now this is really important and not easy. So who shall say he has succeeded? His own soul's vibration. The vibration of the group of disciples with whom he is associated. And, you know, one has to know something of that group. And what its responsibilities are and its duties. And finally, the vibration of the master. All of this is distinct. And we have to practice discrimination, you know, on the, let's say, the fourth subplane of the mental plane. All these are eventually realized as distinct. Mistakes can be made at first. A high vibration comes and one is happy about that and works with it, but where does it come from? There are so many possibilities upward towards the ashram as a whole, or the greater ashram on one's ray, or the hierarchy as a whole, or the Christ himself. There's an extension of possibilities as one refines one's nature. So all three are different, and it is easy to confuse them, especially at first. It is a safe rule for aspirants to assume. Now, see, notice that even he's talking about people who are aspiring to be true disciples, to be true accepted disciples. It's probable that the real disciple who has left major concentration upon the probationary path is called the accepted disciple. It is a safe rule for aspirants to assume when they contact a high vibration and stimulus that it is their own soul contacting them, the master in the heart, and not run off with the idea so flattering to their pride and personality that the master is endeavoring to reach them. How was it that he reached Alice Bailey? The word has it that he saw to the sounding of a certain note in her ear. Sometimes I'm sure, you know, everybody has heard those strange notes, which are musical in a sense and of different pitches and can be very high or not so high, that occur. There is a capability of the inner ear to hear these things. Of course, maybe one is just being tuned up a bit when these things occur, but I think there was a mode of communication between the Tibetan Alice Bailey that involved that sounding of the note to which response had to come. It just wasn't a question of when Alice Bailey was available to do the work. It was a question also of when the Tibetan had time, because I think that the schedules of the great ones are probably amazingly demanding if we were to understand what they are, and would be overwhelming to us. They have a highly organized approach to their inner life, and they are not couch potatoes, you know. Okay, so these are discriminations. And then this is important. These are all factors here which, what can I call them? Factors of relationship, let's just call this factors involved in the relationship between the chela and the master. That's what this section is all about, and it's about group service, not personal contact. He is the one who shuts the door through various debilities that is recognized, and discriminations are needed between vibrations. Discriminations between vibrations. Okay, and now he learns in these factors of relationship that it's not the habit of the masters to flatter or to make promises to their disciples. You know, we're still very much standing on our own two feet. We are still very much standing on our own two feet. The masters want to make masters of us, and that means that we have to master many factors which before remained unmastered. This is hard work. We must subdue and sensitize the lower instruments so the necessary contact is never lost. So nothing of the lower ego or personal self enters this relationship normally. I mean, occasionally advice may be given by the master when something in the lower nature is interfering with that kind of contact which is desirable between a master and his disciple. And this points to their schedule. They are too busy and too wise. That's a joke, I think. Watch out, you know, they know that more harm is done through flattery than through correction or reprimand. And that's something that probably all of us will come to know. Master Moria speaks about the way those who have unwholesome motives use flattery. And he says, you know, watch the flattery be applied. Watch the fruit fall into the hand. People respond so much to the kind words and perhaps don't see the harmful motive behind them. So much discrimination and vibratory recognition is needed in this business of discipleship training. So they're not going to flatter. They're too busy and too wise, nor do they trouble themselves to tell their disciples that they are destined for high office. I knew of a group where this was so, and probably the Theosophical Society had its fair share of promises of a great elevation. Okay, nor do they bother, do they trouble themselves to tell their disciples that they, the disciples, are destined for high office, or that they are their intermediaries and that the hierarchy is depending upon them. You know, all of this flatters the lower personal self. Let's say all such promises and such speech would flatter lower personal self. And blocking real progress. Ambition, you know, it's the sixth head of the Hydra. Love of power, it's all the same. And the self-sufficiency, which characterizes many mental types, test out the struggling aspirant, and he gets from his personality all that he needs in that line. Well, these are tests, and at the third petal, at the sixth petal, at the ninth petal, there's always going to be some heightening sacrifice required, and some detachment from the lower personal self will be affected or effected if things go properly. Ambition of the love of power, sixth petal, sixth head of the Hydra, really. And it's often found in the fifth petal, but by the time we're into the sixth petal, we are sacrificially relinquishing that. It's like the effect of the energy of the sign Virgo, which corrects many of the bombastic tendencies of the Leo energy, quite rampant in the early part of fifth ray unfoldment. I guess we can look at a number of politicians and see them going through this, and other directors. Ambition, love of power, and the self-sufficiency, which characterizes many mental types, test out the struggling aspirant. It's not a bad thing, self-sufficiency, but does this self-sufficiency support the divine plan, or does it repel the word of the soul? And that's world of the soul. So I'll call that word of the soul. And he gets from his personality all that he needs in that line, if he really needs it. These qualities delude him and lead him astray, forcing him onto a pedestal from which he must descend. Well, you know, a number of leaders in the world, are afflicted with the fatal disease of narcissism. They admire their reflection in the river, and they try to embrace it and drown. Or, you know, a similar kind of thing, following this path of self-love, ambition, love of power, a notable self-sufficiency, which is hugged to oneself as a point of pride. These things lead us to the pedestal. It's a kind of a first ray or separative fifth ray reaction. And from that pedestal, which we find in the personal sense at the fifth petal, a fall must come. From the pedestaled position, there must be a fall, and it's called humbling, or, you know, humiliation, a humbling process. So the masters say nothing to feed pride in their disciples, nor do they speak words to them which could foster in their chelas the spirit of separativeness. So rays 1 and 5 are involved here, and also the mental pride of the third ray. Those are, interestingly enough, those rays, 1, 3, and 5, were pointed out by DK as related to the mentality of Germany. It was kind of a fascistic model. I forget the exact word that he used. It was an interesting word, and I think it was in relation to a disciple who didn't really continue because she was so hard. She had a, get this, a first-ray soul, a fifth-ray personality, and a third-ray mind. And he used an appropriate word, and I can't think of it right now. But it was a word that, Prussian. Prussian. These are the Prussian rays, and we know that Prussia was an area in Germany where the kind of overbearing attitude that we associate with some Germans maybe, 100 years ago or a little less, that was the area where that attitude was especially cultivated. Okay, mental pride. Okay, these are the Prussian rays. And they present their prideful obstacles. So, the Tibetan's thought form, one of his thought forms, the one that was causing so much trouble, were giving forth, as I said earlier, good words of mediocre cheer and encouragement. Good words of mediocre cheer and encouragement. That's my disciple. That a boy, that a girl, you're really going now. No, those things would create barriers between the true spiritual energies and the energies which are falsely assumed to be true. Okay, now we go further in this, these factors which are part of the, what can we say here? Factors, certain factors, relationship factors, factors involved in the relationship between the master and his disciple. And here's point E. The disciple soon finds also that masters are not easily accessible. They're on the lookout, for emergency conditions and for contacts that promote the work of the ashram, but they're not there always to be holding our hand, are they? They are busy men, ill able to spare even a few moments in which to communicate with the disciple, and only in emergencies, in the case of a beginner on the path of discipleship, do the masters expend the necessary energy with which to get en rapport. So, that a master may contact you is not necessarily a flattering thing. It can mean you are a beginner and in trouble. So we really have to always watch out for this kind of reflexive self exaltation. It is a problem, and this mistaken identity of the little me as being the real me or the real I has to be worn away gradually. Master Moria tells us that, implies that the way to do that is through cosmic perception. And in general, get the big picture. See how small you are. Get a sense of proportion. Drop all narcissism. The world is not revolving around you. You have to begin to shrink to become a tiny point in the field of your consciousness and not take up all that space in the field, crowding out other things that are more important, such as the whole group project and the plan's destiny for humanity. If we're all too self-important, we're not going to see things in proportion. This is an interesting Leo and Libra problem. The sun of egotism falls in Libra, and it corrects the egotistical Leo response in the beginning. You know, Leo later can be the source of what DK heights of service. Heights of service are reached in Leo and Aquarius. But in the beginning, egotism is a problem, and the sun is the lower ego or the lower personal self, and it falls in Libra, where a sense of proportion is given. And DK interestingly discusses the reversal of the wheel and the kind of horoscopic indications which tell us that this might be a possibility, and Leo and Libra are involved in the horoscope. Maybe Sun and Leo and Libra rising, something like that. And that would help with the reversing of the direction of the energy so that they do not emphasize the personality. The real meaning of the reverse wheel has to do with the direction and elevation of energy currents within the etheric body of man or of any system in which that reversal has to occur. With old and tried disciples, and I almost use the word tired, with old and tried disciples, the contacts are more frequent, being more easily achieved, and bearing more rapid results. But the disciple doesn't want to take the master's time. The old and tried disciple does not want to bother the master with his own relatively unimportant problems. So even though it's easier to get through, there's every effort made to avoid importuning the master overmuch, just as DK tells us to avoid importuning our solar angel overmuch, as it has its own required duties regarding higher telepathy and such things. It should be remembered, however, says the Tibetan, that the newer the disciple, the more he demands attention and considers he should have it. I don't know, somehow, to me, there's an undercurrent of dry humor in all this, unless it's because I can just say to myself, this I have seen. The older and more experienced servers seek to fulfill their obligations and carry forward their work with as little contact with the master as may be possible. I remember, I don't know, taught me a lesson in retrospect. I was pretty good in math and in geometry and things like that, but somehow I thought that it was a good thing to come in early to talk to the teacher, who always made herself available at an early hour for students who had difficulty with this or that. And I wasn't having difficulty. I just showed up and liked talking to the teacher. And now I realize, well, I hope I wasn't blocking out others who needed the help more than I did. But I guess my motive could have been better. Thinking back in those days, she was really a good teacher of geometry. That's the, you know, the second ray type of mathematics, especially the great geometrician or the grand geometrician. They seek to save the master's time, the older and more experienced disciples, and frequently consider an interview with the master as demonstrating failure on their part, and producing, therefore, regret that they've had to take the master's precious time and force him to use his energy in order to safeguard the work from error and the disciple, perhaps, from harm. Well, as I was saying, it's a different attitude, isn't it? It's not a selfish attitude at all. It's one that sees the work in a greater perspective. Excuse me, the aim of every high disciple is to carry out his work and be en rapport with the spiritual force center, which is his group, or let's say, you know, his ashram, and thus be in steady touch with the master without interviews and phenomenal contacts. I suppose something like this, an interview is confirmation, but it also is time consuming. And so this is interesting, isn't it? It rather changes our attitude regarding contact with the master. Many only expect to contact their masters once a year, usually at the time of the full moon in May, and this is a big occult hint about when it is more legitimate to contact the master and not importune overly much. So here we go, a strong hint here. And really, as the as the Buddha, let's see, B-D-D-H, oh heavens, can't be that bad, can it? B-D-A, huh, as simple as that. All right, as the Buddha said in his last sermon, and I repeat it often, don't I? In his last sermon, something we all have to understand, rely upon your, and I'm going to capitalize it, rely upon yourself. Because the self is not the personal self. That's not the one to be relied upon, although it does have abilities which can be used. But the higher self, which has the answers and which can direct. The higher self has the answers and can direct the personality. So it's pretty down to earth, isn't it? You know, the Buddha tells us to rely upon ourselves, and it's a good sign, I'm sure. When the masters see that happening, it's a good sign. They consider it a good sign because we're getting one more disciple who can stand on his own two feet. Okay, then more point F about the relationship of a master to his disciple. He finds also that the relationship between master and disciple is governed by law, and that there are definite stages of contact and grades in the desired rapport. Now, we learn somehow about that when we're given the instruction in discipleship in the New Age. I think it's volume 2 about how to approach the ashram and what are the different stages of approach. These can be enumerated but not enlarged upon. Does he do that? Yeah, he kind of does that, and the enumeration in Dina, I think it's 2, is also very important. Let's see, it's the, if I use the word, you know, a word sticks to my mind, vanishing alcove, maybe that'll do it, A-L-C-O-V-E, there's only one, it's a rare word, so here are the, it's the stage of the withdrawing alcove. So, let's just say it's not convenient really to copy all this and put it in, but the stage of the awakening urge, the stage of advance, the stage of leaving each pillar behind its shadow, the stage of the withdrawing alcove, the stage which is given the name the rite of entry. These 5 stages from 635 to where? 632. I'll say, so note in Dina 2, pages, if I put 2 P's, what will happen? Oh, that'll be all right. 6:32 to 6:35. Looks like we have the stages of approach into the ashram. And I suppose that this material, which is fairly advanced material, should be also discussed in relationship to what's given here. Well, I think, you know, the approach, the symbolic approach given in Dinah 2 is important to study, but here are the stages of discipleship, which are really stages of entry into the ashram. So I'm just going to sort of mention these, and then we'll take them up in the next program. These are the six stages of discipleship and correspond to deeper entry into the ashram. So how, in other words, he does enlarge upon them elsewhere, interestingly enough, and these are stages of rapport with the master. An accepted disciple is in touch with the master, and a line of direct connection exists. Okay. So, just to mention these, the stage wherein the disciple is contacted by the master through another chela on the physical plane. This is little chelaship. It's connected with the first initiation. The stage wherein a higher disciple directs the chela from the egoic level, the higher mental plane, and this is called the chela in the light. And then here are the five confirmations of accepted discipleship: a vivid dream experience, a symbolic teaching, a using of a thought form of the master, a contact in meditation, and a definite remembered interview in the master's ashram. And this last one is definitely the stage of accepted discipleship. You know, as a matter of fact, I'll read this, but then we will go over it next time. Number four, the stage wherein, having shown his wisdom and work and his appreciation of the master's problem, the disciple is taught how, in emergencies, to attract the master's attention and thus draw on his strength and knowledge and advice. And this is an instantaneous happening and practically takes none of the master's time. This stage has the peculiar name of a chela on the thread, or sutratma. I guess there's more to the thread than the sutratma, but it's a triple thread, but still chela on the thread. Five, the stage wherein he is permitted to know the method whereby he may set up vibration and a call which will entitle him to an interview with the master. This is only permitted to those trusted chelas who can be depended upon not to use the knowledge for anything except the need of the work. No personality, reason, or distress would prompt them to use it. At this stage, the disciple is called the one within the aura. And finally, number six, the stage wherein the disciple can get the master's ear at any time. He is in close touch always. This is the stage wherein a chela is definitely prepared for an immediate initiation, or, having taken initiation, is being given specialized work to do in collaboration with his... Well, why is that blank? Is there a mistake here? Maybe ashram master. At this stage, he is described as one within his master's heart, and a later stage comes, one of identification. So let's just... I think the thing for us to do here is, having read these, to say that this will be the end of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 39, and it's 5.4, page 169 to, how far should we go? Let's say 172. And then beginning of A Treatise on White Magic, video commentary number 40. Oh, we're getting there, huh? It will be 5.5. And we'll start with 172, almost into 173, and go on. Just to look at this quickly, documents, and see exactly where we are. Yes, and this we are finishing up with number 39 at 5.3. Okay, friends, well, I understand and see how Master DK sets down certain lists and tabulations and does not necessarily elaborate them at the moment, but chooses a later time to elaborate them. Every one of these stages is elaborated in Dina 1 at the end of the book, under the six stages of discipleship. So we will move forward and continue to think about these things and apply them to our life of discipleship as much as that is possible for us. So very best to all of you, many blessings, and we'll see you before long.